Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to once again attend the Libertarian Conference and to have so many people turn out for it. I'm also kind of a tough spot here in a sense, personally, because I'm itching to get into the previous debate. which obviously is the climactic point of the conference, but I will refrain. Maybe I can sneak something in the course of an attack on the Chicago school. the basic problem, I think, the fundamental basic problem with Chicago, well, first place, if you ask the average person, the average intellectual or reader of Time magazine or whatever, about free market economics, if he knows anything about it at all, he'll identify it with Milton Friedman or other Chicago economists. So they have sort of preempted the field of free market economics in this country. One way they're able to do this, they have a very strong sectarian sense, which I don't blame them for particularly, but they have it. And so that they push each other into positions and get each other jobs, that sort of thing. So they have a strong sense of intra-Chicago solidarity. The basic problem, I think, from the point of view of true freedom, liberty, and justice about the Chicago school, well, there are a couple of basic problems. One basic problem is their attitude toward the state. They regard the state as an equivalent arm of social action. In other words, you've got the market out here, you've got voluntary clubs out there, and you've got the state over here, and they're all about the same. There's no moral distinction, no logical distinction between the two or three of them. So that the Chicago Right is never against government action because they're moral or criminal or whatever. He considers it another social tool of government. Well, when you look at each situation ad hoc, should the government build steel plants? Well, we look at the situation, we examine the statistical correlations, etc. And we usually wind up with conclusions they shouldn't because it's less efficient than the market doing. But you'll never know from one ad hoc problem to the next what the Chicago Right is going to come up with, because each area, each field is a separate, distinct field for investigation. The Chicago Right has no general theory attacking the state or considering the state is even somehow different in any way from a private action. Correlated to this is the fact that Chicago Whites have no theory of justice in property rights. In other words, they talk a lot about private property, at least in the last few years. But their view of private property is purely instrumental. In other words, government decides who should get this property. They arrive at it from the point of view of social efficiency, in quotes. I personally don't think there is such a concept as social efficiency. But they arrive at it from the point of view of social efficiency. They say, it looks like it's more efficient to assign property rights in this area than to have it communally owned. And it doesn't make any difference who we assign it to, because it all works out the same. It all comes out the same in the wash. A famous example of this is the problem of air pollution. For example, the railroad locomotive is chugging down the road and smoke is coming out of the smokestack and blighting the orchards of the neighboring farmers. And the question is, who should pay who? Who owns the property? Should the railroads have to compensate the farmers for the damage? Or should the farmers have to beg the railroads to stop by paying them off, paying the railroads to put in a smokeless smokestack? According to the Chicago Right, it doesn't make any, they like to see either one done. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever which one is done. My point of view, I think the Austrian point of view in general as well, is it doesn't make a difference. It's a fundamental moral question, who gets the property. From my point of view, the farmers own the property, they own the orchards, and the railroad should be stopped or forced to pay damages or whatever for any invasion of that property. And in other words, what happens is that the Chicago School, starting off the idea of completely value-free economics, economics supposedly shorn of any kind of moral or ethical position, why not, however, taking all sorts of moral, political positions, all sorts of, making all sorts of political statements, presumably also value-free. In other words, you have this leap from supposedly value-free science to a supposedly value-free politics, which I don't think can exist. And it's done on various bases. One of them, say, the state is some sort of a neutral tool. And two, the concept of so-called social efficiency in some way. It's more efficient to have a government do such and such, or to have private do such and such. From my point of view, if they really want to be value-free, then they should make no statements about politics at all. They should shut up about politics. But of course, they don't. Particularly glaring example of this is the question of taxes, which of course is a key element in government operation. I have to say here for my fellow Austrians, the Austrians have been very weak on tax theory also. They really have very little to say about theory of taxes. And as a matter of fact, this is true for limited government types in general, I must say. If a limited government person favors taxes, which most of them do, I'm exempting objectivists in this discussion, but most of the government people, of course, favor taxes. Another question is, how do you raise the taxes, and which taxes, and so forth and so on, and what are justifications for this or that, and it gets pretty dicey. Well, usually the Austrian position on taxes, they like to have a lower tax structure as possible, which I go along with, and two, that it should not be progressive. The income taxes should not be progressive, for example. And three, they should somehow be neutral with respect to the market, which is of course, really impossible. But this is just about as far as Austrians will go in a tax theory. But at least most Austrians aren't really enamored of taxes. They don't consider taxes somehow a lovable instrument. Where Chicagoites really do, once they get around to the doctrine that taxes are really more efficient in this particular area. So if you turn to the Chicago writings on taxation, there's a big yen for taxes in many ways. For example, I remember a few years ago there was a meeting of the Malpalaran Society, which is a group of international free market, semi-free market, and one-tenth free market economists and social philosophers and journalists and businessmen. And they gather every year at the Pleasant Summer Resort, and one year, three Chicagoans zeroed in on Belgium or wherever the meeting was held, and three of them had independently arrived with this magnificent theory of a new kind of tax. I don't know if they've ever published this, but at any rate, they arrived at this, and it was all great minds, working independently on a problem, or arrived at the same solution. They arrived at this, and the tax went as follows, and this, I think, is sort of indicative of the Chicagoite mentality and Chicagoite attitude toward property in general. It went something like this. Here's what we do. We get everybody to assess his own property. In other words, I have a set of books, or you have a house, or a factory, or whatever it is. Each guy puts down his own assessment. Well, that's pretty good, because if each guy is allowed to put his own assessment down, then any kind of Gestapo investigation, the usual, of course, temptation to put out a valuation of something like half a penny, and then you pay your rate on it. Ah, but there's a clinker here, which Chicago people worked out. If you are forced by the government to sell this particular property to anybody who comes along at that rate. So they really wrapped this up. This is somehow the answer to the tax question. Is more efficient. You don't have to have a big arm of assessors investigating what your property really is. Let the guy assess it himself, and then whatever schmo down the block comes along and says, okay, you say your house is worth half a cent, here's a half a penny, and you're forced to sell it to him. That right? And at this meeting, Paul Friedrich Hayek, a distinguished free market Austrian economist, was very concerned about this, particularly he has a distinguished book collection. And he said, well, my God, this means that if I you know, if I value a set of the books, my books, at, you know, the going price, let's say, this means that I would be forced to sell it to anybody. And this means, of course, if I value the books very highly, I have to put an enormous assessment on it. See, in other words, especially if you know that some people have to get you, you know, they want to destroy your books. You have to put an assessment of $10 billion in your book collection, which means you have to pay, you know, $100,000 a year, or whatever the property tax will be, which you might not have. So of course, the Chicago answer, you know, what about my books? Hayek, what Hayek said, and then the end, of course, the Chicago line answer was, a tough on your books. I think this really sums up the Chicago position on taxes. It's a position of brutal indifference to genuine property right and a desire to clean up the state. In other words, make the state as efficient as possible. See, the thing is, the Chicago people look, for example, the notorious Friedman negative income tax, which I don't know if I want to go into it like, but at any rate, Friedman looks around at the welfare system. It's a big mess, right? No question about that. I think anybody would argue about this. Every city, every state, every region has its own crazy system, et cetera, et cetera. And it's inefficient, and there are all sorts of bureaucrats who get papers lost and things of that sort. There's a lot of red tape to get into it. So the theory is, you make it more efficient. Make the system more efficient, you have a guaranteed minimum income, is what it amounts to. And you pay the guy through the tax, through the income tax form. So he sends in, I'm simplifying this, of course, a great deal, but in essence, this is what it is. If the minimum is set at $2,000 a year, if your income happens to be $500 a year, you submit your form to the income to the IRS, and you get back $1,500. Now, of course, people will make certain adjustments to try to weaken some of the disincentive effect, which is pretty obvious in this thing. But basically, this is what happens. In other words, everybody gets that automatic claim on production. Instead of having to shuffle through a large welfare bureaucracy, and get lost in the shuffle and get stepped on by arrogant welfare workers and that sort of thing, you simply submit your form and you get the money. This might be more efficient in the sense of lower cost, greater uniformity, and the rest of it, but it also means automatic claim on production instead of a sort of a shuffling, inefficient claim, which I think would have much more disastrous effect. I mean, an enormous shift from production to the welfare to the negative income tax goal. But this is typical of the attitude. Now, for example, Milton Friedman is very proud of the fact that he was one of the people most instrumental in pushing through the withholding tax system in this country. He was working for the U.S. Treasury Department during the war and came up with this brilliant idea, withholding tax. You see, the problem is if you didn't have a withholding tax, the whole income tax structure would collapse because, before the war it got along fairly well because taxes were pretty low. But if you try to extract 20%, 30%, 70% income tax from a person, and you let him, you say, well, it's due on April 15th, period, the guy's simply not going to, he's not going to diligently save up over the year and then hand it to the government. It would be a tremendous headache of enforcement, the thing would break down. So Friedman and his colleagues come up with a brilliant idea of extracting it painlessly every day from his paycheck, using, of course, the employer as your unpaid agent in this regard. So, this makes the income tax system much more efficient. It allows the growth of an enormous Leviathan state, enormous income tax burden and criminality, etc. And it's done in the name of efficiency. And in fact, it is more efficient. But when it comes to the state operation, in my view, the less efficiency, the better. It's like talking about the operations of a criminal gang. You don't want them to be efficient. You know exactly where the back space is and how to get it going. You want them to be bumbled like these Italian comedies, As a matter of fact, there's a great story about, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but a great story anyway, about Charles F. Kettering, a distinguished free market industrialist. And he was trying to cheer up a friend of his who was in the hospital. The friend, of course, as Kettering was, were complaining about the growth of government, how terrible it was, and so forth and so on. And finally, Kettering said, "Cheer up, Jim. thank God that we don't get as much government as we pay for. Which I think sums up the question of efficiency. If you're going to have to have the tax burden to the sector, at least let the money leak out along the way so you don't have an efficient juggernaut coming to oppress you. And this is essentially what the Chicago Y position does. The Chicago Y is a technician. He's an economic technician. Society, in quote, sets the ends for which he's working, and that means the state, as a so-called representative of society, sets the ends. And as Chicago widely is a technical advisor, you know, how do you, something like these Rand Corporation types, trying to decide where's the most efficient place to place the A-bomb or whatever. Where's the most efficient pinpoint, how do you fix the state up so it's more efficient in its job of taxing and governing and subsidizing and whatever. And I think that's essentially what the Chicago Y position amounts to. Aside from that, aside from this attitude of efficiency, we have another problem with the Chicago position, which is the original founding father of the Chicago School, Henry C. Simon. I think it's a very instructive assignment for everybody. Go and read Simon's famous book, A Positive Program for Laissez-Faire, which he came out with, I think, in 1934. And because, you see, everybody before him, before the laissez-faire, was essentially negative. In other words, you tell the government, leave us alone. And government's not supposed to do much. And Simon said, no, not from my view of government. The government's out there doing a hell of a lot. It's a positive program. The positive program is essentially three things, I think. One is a very, very drastic egalitarian progressive income tax system. You smash the rich. You take almost, you know, compulsory egalitarianism. You smash the rich and give all the money. You tax the income of everybody above a certain amount, and you pay the money to everybody below a certain amount. Now, we see in this, and one of the problems here is that, of course, the Simons and the Chicago School believe that you can do this without affecting incentives at all, aside from the moral problem involved. The guy will still be working to maximize his profit and his income, etc. And then you seize the money from him and give it to somebody else. It's not supposed to affect the matter. These are two sort of different isolated compartments, which we know incidentally now in economics, unfortunately, is micro and macro. You got micro over here, where you have free markets and supply and demand, and we have other goodies. Then you have macro, the government's out there taxing and regulating and printing money and all the rest of it. And the twain never meet. I mean, you know, there's never any effect of one of the macro on the micro. And this is one of the problems of Chicagoism. Chicagoism has taken us over from orthodox economics. So you have this very drastic progressive income tax set up. The present Chicago School has happily weakened this. I mean, they've given up. They've retreated a great deal from the Simon position. There's still this trailing cloud of glory that we get from Henry C. Simon. There's still the negative income tax of Friedman is an example of this. You tax everybody above a certain amount, pay out money to those below it. Friedman would not advocate progressive income tax, but this is essentially what it amounts to. It's at least progressive in the sense that the guy below, of course, 2,000 or whatever, is not paying anything. Also, there's various other things that Chicagoites come up with from time to time. For example, the Chicago position now favors local government subsidies to factories. You induce factories to come into the state of the South. Southern rural areas or whatever, the right factories come in there, so it's legitimate for government, local government to subsidize. Then there's another position they came up with, I think Professor Buchanan, who might have shifted over from Chicago to Austrianism a year or so ago, but this was in a Chicago incarnation. Buchanan was worried about the external diseconomies again, and the so-called neighborhood effect of crowding and noise and all that, say in Los Angeles. I think he conceived the idea when he was a visiting professor at UCLA. He began to worry about urban growth and, you know, noise and congestion. Before that, he'd been in Charlottesville, Virginia, but it didn't have much of a problem. And he said, well, let's see, there's three ways to handle this. One is you can enforce property rights. For example, you can enforce the property right against noise invasion of your property or against air pollution against your lungs. And you quickly dismiss that. Well, it's just utopian. Dismiss that very quickly. That's out. The second thing he could do, which he really pumped for, is the ideal solution, is to set up a migration barrier in California, not permitting any outlander to move to California from the Middle West or wherever, or set up immigration barriers in New York. Then he sighed and said, well, he admits that's unconstitutional, probably wouldn't be able to amend the Constitution to permit immigration barriers within the country. So for the third best approximation, he pumps for the idea of taxing the people in Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York, and using that money to subsidize Appalachia and other rural areas in order to keep them there so they wouldn't create headaches by migrating to the city. That's a typical Chicagoite solution. Whatever we may say about it, has nothing to do with free markets. It's pretty clear. There are other examples of this point of view toward taxes and ad hoc solutions. Is the Friedman position, for example, about air pollution, water pollution. I don't want to get into technicalities of that, the whole pollution question here, but the point is that their solution to it is a typical ad hoc utilitarian thing. Well, we meaning the government, of course, we decide how much pollution we want as opposed to how much industrial progress we want, how much we balance the factories as against the lung cancer or emphysema. We get some kind of a measure of social cost versus social benefit, and then we tax the industries up to the pollution, up to this level. So we make sure that they only pollute a certain amount, and not more than the social benefit outweighing the social cost outweighing the social benefit. But the Austrian position is there's no such thing as social cost and social benefit. They're only individual costs and benefits, which you can't measure one against the other. But at any rate, this is, again, a typical situation. The government sits down with wisdom and decides its values, which is supposed to represent the public as a whole in some way, some obscure manner, and then this is imposed upon everybody in society through the tax subsidy adjustment. There's also, I thought I mentioned Simon's three great positive functions for government. One of them was to smash everybody making over 5,000 or 10,000, whatever thing is, per year. Another one was extreme, unlimited, fanatical trust busting. So that every corporation above the side of a small blacksmith shop smashed, reduced down to that level, broken up, with extreme. And he used it very consistently. He used that against unions also. Unions would be broken up, corporations would be broken up, everybody would be broken up. And this too has more or less died out of the Chicago school and other fanatical trust busters they used to be. But the theory is still there. In other words, the theoretical framework of Chicago economics still says that pure competition, is better than impure, imperfect competition. And imperfect competition means real world competition. There is no other than imperfect, in quotes. Imperfect is sort of a loaded term, that's part of the whole problem. At any rate, they still have the theory that pure competition is better than impure. And even though they say in practice government is the main source of monopoly, and therefore we have to zero in on repealing government privileges and so forth and so on, but still the theory is back there of a canker, no bigger than a man's hand, which once in a while pops out. For example, it wasn't too many years ago, Professor George Siegler, number two man on the Chicago hierarchy, so to speak, advocated before a committee of Congress the breaking up of U.S. Steel as being monopolistic and busted into constituent parts. So every once in a while, the old trust-busting element will pop up in Chicagoism. I'll get to the sign of the third sphere of government later, but there's also the Chicago argument for neighborhood effect. This is not only a Chicago argument, this is a general orthodox current economic argument, which is one of the reasons, one of the things I have against Chicago is essentially they're not too different from regular economics. This is one of the reasons why they're so popular in the economic profession. They favor the free market, except if they're neighborhood effects. In other words, except if anything that you do affects the guy next to you, affects somebody else in society. Now, of course, this is, from my point of view, this is an open sesame to any kind of intervention, because anything you do affects somebody, somewhere. I mean, if I read Human Action, it benefits, I acquire more wisdom and it benefits other people who come in contact with me, and therefore, in order to internalize the cost and all that sort of thing, they should be such that they should be taxed to pay me to read you Max. In other words, you're not capturing, not internalizing the cost, and therefore somebody's got to do it for you. In other words, the government's got to step in and correct the so-called defect in the market. If I'm enjoying the example I used to use in class, which used to be pretty effective before women's lib came around, was mini skirts. Especially all male schools, even more effective. The point being that if you watch and enjoy the sight of girls walking down the street in miniskirts, you're getting a psychic benefit from this. According to Chicago position, you should be taxed to subsidize them to wear miniskirts because you're not capturing the cost, the benefit. I'm getting a free benefit, so to speak, a free rider in the situation. This permeates, again, I think as Friedman himself will limit this argument to two things, basically. One is urban parks. For some reason, he's very worried about places like Central Park, because if Central Park were private, my God, somebody on Columbus Avenue might look at Central Park and be able to enjoy a leaf of tall trees, and you're not capturing that benefit. You're not making them pay for it. I'm not really concerned with making people pay for stuff. I mean, that's not my shtick. I don't see why this is particularly better. I can see a lot of reasons why it's worse than a free system. If I don't have a membership in Central Park, I'm not an annual member, let's say, in a private park, I might be able to watch the trees, and nobody's going to, unless the Freedmen Gestapo will get after me and humor me for doing it. But I wouldn't be able to be in the park. I'd still be a second class citizen. I still wouldn't be able to really enjoy the park itself. I can only watch the outside. The things of that sort really bother Chicagoites. It makes them pay, sort of thing. If it so happens the free market doesn't make them pay. But he limits it to two things, I say, basically. One is urban parks, because he recognizes Yellowstone, you can keep people out. You can't enjoy Yellowstone Park very well from out there. But another thing is education, which is, of course, a very big deviation from Friedman, that he favors government payment for government subsidy and payment for people for the education of all kids, not necessarily in public schools, but a payment through the tax system. Because one kid is educated, I'm being benefited, he's a better kid. I mean, to put it simply, he's more productive. Well, yeah, if he's more productive, in my view, let him pay for it, or his parents. Or if I fall for the Friedman view, if I fall for the idea of neighborhood effect, which I think is a lot of nonsense anyway, but if I believe it, I can voluntarily subsidize a kid. In a free society, I'd be free to do this. But this is not enough for the neighborhood effect position. You have to be forced to quote to subsidize his education. But he would limit it. Friedman would essentially limit this to urban parks and education. You can apply it to anything. You can apply it anywhere else, all the way down the line, to subsidizing miniskirts, to subsidizing anything. Reading newspapers, my God, I read the Times, I benefit, I learn something, so everybody should be taxed to pay me to read it, and so forth and so on. And interestingly enough, if you challenge a Chicagoite with this argument, he will say, logically you're correct, but who's going to apply this to this case, which is, I think, interesting commentary on the consistency of the general intellectual standards that are around today's culture. So the neighborhood effect, I say, leaves a hole in the defense of the market big enough for a Mack truck to ride into. And those people on the left were smart enough to realize this and, of course, take full advantage of the neighborhood effect gap. Another problem is, I mentioned neighborhood effect. I mentioned negative income tax. I think it would be a total disaster. I hope that the president. And Congress right now is a left-right coalition, a very peculiar sort, against the Family Assistance Plan, as it's called, essentially the Friedman Plan. Leftists don't want to go further, and right-wingers don't want to go that far. And this plan this coalition was able to block the thing last year. I don't know if it'll have the same effect this year. Anyway, I foresee a fantastic disincentive effect of enormous proportions. To put it briefly, Wherever you set the floor, let's say you set the floor at 2,000. That means that the guy making 2,100 a year is becomes to get rather disgruntled and rather edgy by the whole setup. But he is paying taxes to support those lazy bums out of block who are making zero and are now getting 2,000 from the government. He's getting nothing from the government. So his small, in other words, his marginal return over and above the guy's on the dole, on the guaranteed dole, is $100 per year, working 40 hours a week or whatever, getting a net return of $100 from his work. I think there's going to be strong inclination for him to drop out and receive the 2,000. And as he drops out, this is what we choose for people making 2,100, 2,200, 2,800, 3,000, et cetera, et cetera. As these guys drop out, this, of course, will add more people on the dole. The course will go up. The tax cost on the people still working will keep going up. And this will induce more people to leave the working and go on the dole. So you have a fantastic vicious circle. Now, the cost estimates that Friedman and other people have given about how much this thing would amount to per year seem pretty reasonable, you know, $10 billion or whatever it is. I mean, since the budget goes up about $20 billion every year anyway, you say, well, man, why not devote $10 billion to this? But all these cost estimates assume that everybody will keep working in the same intensity and degree as they do now, which, of course, is a clinker in the whole argument. It's the question begging the clinker. The point is they will not keep working unless they're complete dolts. They will join the automatic dole, the automatic 2,000. There will be no stigma attached to it. It's one of the things that the Friedmanites are concerned with. You've got to remove the stigma from being on welfare. Okay, the stigma's removed, everybody gets on it. Which, of course, is the real point, which is really forgotten now, because Friedman and Chicago people consider themselves as heirs of 19th century liberals. They're not, really. The 19th century liberals are much better than that. And the reason why 19th century liberals were in favor of the stigma and crummy workhouses with, ceilings falling down every once in a while, things of that sort, was precisely because they wanted to have a strong negative incentive for people not to go on welfare. This was the real point. This has been forgotten in the present so-called free market people. So, and as this happens, the thing snowballs, accelerates, and you increase the taxes and so forth. You know, until finally, I think you wind up with the conditions of everybody being on the dole, nobody working, and then the government will be hard put to it to come up with any kind of goods and services to pay out at all to these people. Aside from this, of course, is a problem which everybody realizes, is that $2,000 will not remain $2,000 very long. Immediately political pressures come in, it should be $3,000, because the official poverty level, in quotes, put out by the Department of Labor is $3,000, that's sort of like a magic figure. It's got to be $3,000, that's what you have to have a 7% cost of living increase every year prices go up 7%. And then so the thing sort of escalates, the floor will keep escalating in addition to everything else. I foresee complete disaster if the negative income tax guarantee income goes through. So that's one big area, clinker area. The free market solution, or the libertarian solution to the welfare question, of course, is that, well, and there's several steps. One is that free market capitalism is the thing which eliminates poverty, which has brought us up from the caves to the present system, which has created the Industrial Revolution and so forth. And secondly, that whatever poverty does exist can be aided by voluntary effort, either self-help, short-term programs, community help programs, or whatever. All of which, since voluntary agencies, for example, do not have the unlimited funds that the state has, all of which will necessarily be based on the idea of helping people to help themselves, to get them on their feet, which is again was a 19th century view of private charity, voluntary charity. And of course, also the values of the public, the values of the groups on welfare come in here. There's a charming article, I don't know how many people saw it, the New York Times, I think, about a year ago, about the Albanian population in New York City. I didn't know there were any Albanians in New York City, but there are. And they just set up their first Albanian church anywhere in the world. Apparently, the church is outlawed in Albania. So,
And the Albanians are very, very poor. There are no wealthy Albanians in New York. There's probably no wealthy Albanians anywhere. Anyway, it's certainly not in New York. And Albanians are very poor, and the Albanian spokesman was saying, there are no Albanians on welfare, period. They said, how come it's a very poor group? Well, he said, Albanians regard being on welfare as begging on the street, and they refuse to beg, period. And they manage it so they don't get on welfare. So cultural values, social attitudes, etc., also enter the equation. At any rate, going on to the third big sign on Chicago deviation from the free market, there's the whole money government spending area. Essentially, somebody said recently in an article about the Chicago school, the reason why they didn't become Keynesians is that they were Keynesians before Keynes ever wrote. So they didn't have to, they didn't fall under the sway of the Keynesian Revolution. During the early 1930s, they were considered leftish, radical, socialistic by the Chicago school, by the rest of the profession, because they advocated enormous public works during these sessions, inflationary credit, going off the gold standard, and so forth and so on. And these people, old line economists, classical economists, were correct. They were socialistic in that sense. But what happened, of course, the rest of the economic profession has moved much more socialistic since then, so they look like free marketeers at this point. But their position still remains basically the same. And that is that the government, the job of the government, first place, is supposed to have, the government is supposed to have absolute control of the monetary system, absolute dictation over money. And the way you get absolute dictation over money is to abolish gold altogether, or silver, or any other commodity, and make money the legal ticket put out by the government, by the Treasury. The Treasury puts out a ticket, the Federal Reserve Board puts out a ticket saying $1 or $10. You make that money and nothing else. So this means that this money is another of the market economy. This is the single most important commodity or element in the economy, since money participates in every exchange that you ever make in the system. This means if you allow government total control of money, you allow government really total control of the whole system. You've given up before you've even started. And this is what the Chicagoites advocate doing. Chicago's position on money is to cut all even present tenuous. Right now we have a very tenuous and ridiculous, but still there, length of the international gold. They would cut it completely and have freely fluctuating exchange rates between the dollar and other currencies. Which puts the absolute control of the money demand completely in the hands of the state without even the balance of payments check. And now, at least once in a while, we have a balance of payments crisis. This puts a limit upon government inflation of money. But the Chicago school, there would be no limit. The only limit would be Milton Friedman telling them, please don't inflate more than 2-3% per year money supply. In other words, Friedman telling, admonishing, hectoring, haranguing the Federal Reserve System, now you're inflating too much, now you're inflating too little. You should only inflate 3%, 4%. It keeps changing the figures with something like 3-4% per year. What is there to prevent, what is there to force or compel or impel the Federal Reserve System to do this? Nothing, just Friedman. I mean, in other words, you give all power to the central government, all power over money, then you try to tell them, please limit the inflation, you don't want too much. And I think this is a ridiculous way to proceed, but it's a way, again, which is consistent with the Chicago position of being sort of technical advisors to the state. You have all power to the state, and you advise them technically, no, you shouldn't do that because it's inefficient, it messes this thing up here and there, please don't do that. It's sort of like the advisor of the court of Caligula, or whatever, don't burn the city because it's, reducing the gross national product, or whatever the advice is. It's not going to be very effective, my prediction. Mr. Friedman was interested in social prediction, so the key to truth. My prediction is not going to work, and it hasn't. The reason why Friedman wants a 2-3% per year inflation, I guess to be rather technical, I don't want to get into that, but basically it's the old Chicago Simon position of stabilizing the price level. The price level should remain constant. This became sort of a mystical idea, literally, of the Chicago school. Somehow a constant price level is the thing. It means that money is performing its measuring function and so forth and so on. Suffice it to say on this, on a truly free market, unhampered by government inflation and government banking and government money, Prices generally tend to fall considerably. As the supply of goods and services and productivity increases, prices fall, just like the price of TV sets has fallen from $2,000 for a crummy set to 20 years ago to, you know, $60 or $100 for a very good set now. This is generally what happens with prices on a free market. For some reason, Chicago people hate this idea, and they want the government to step in to keep the force of price levels remain constant at all times. And this leads them to this idea of 3% inflation and money supplies to balance the increases in goods and services, etc. There's also a difference in business cycle theory, but I don't, again, get a little technical to go into that. Again, I just want to say that there's a bit of confusion among some people because both Friedman and Austrians agree the Federal Reserve System was responsible for the 1929 Depression. So it's considered that they really agree basically on the whole problem. They don't. It's completely the opposite. In other words, the Austrian view is that the 1929 Depression was brought about by Federal Reserve Board expansion of the money supply during the 1920s and even later, which brought about a situation which, you know, caused a depression. In other words, monetary inflation by the Federal Reserve System bringing about an inevitable recession, a depression. The Friedman position is that the Federal Reserve Board didn't inflate enough, that they held back to their proper role of enormous inflation to offset falling prices, etc. So the Friedman position and the Austrian position is exactly the opposite. Both are zero in on the role of the Federal Reserve System, that's true. But each one has a completely different view. The Chicago position is that they should have inflated more. The Austrian position is they shouldn't have inflated it at all. A slight difference. I think that that more or less sums up at least the political economy distinction. There are all sorts of methodological and philosophical critiques I could make of Chicago School. I think they're in a sense worse philosophically than they are even in politics. That's a whole other realm. The two things, of course, again, lap over, as I try to say, that theory of property and justice and so forth. Sum it up, I think what the problem is, the free market, in quotes, which would exist under Chicago system, would be only under the sufferance of the central government and its advisors, technical advisors. If they thought for 1 minute, at any point, that the free market was, quote, not efficient, unquote, in relation to some other scheme, they would abandon it and abolish it. On the Chicago scheme, therefore, we have no defense against state oppression whatsoever. Thank you.